had. After spending all of 1998 ferociously defending adultery as something everyone does and everyone lies about, liberals claim to be shocked to the core that anyone would compare homosexuality to such a morally black sin as adultery. While we're in a sensitive mood, how about the name the Dixie Chicks? Isn't that name provocative to African Americans? When you get liberals to come out against both looting and adultery in the same week, you know the left is in a state of total disarray. They shouldn't feel so bad. Their boys put up a good fight in Iraq for 17 days. We Don't Care, June 4, 2003. Liberals have started in with their female taunting about weapons of mass destruction. The way they carry on, you would think they had caught the Bush administration in some shocking mendacity. You know how the left can't stand a liar. For the sake of their tiresome argument, let's stipulate that we will find no weapons of mass destruction, or, to be accurate, no more weapons of mass destruction. Perhaps Hussein was using the 3 trucks capable of assembling poison gases to sell ice cream under some heretofore undisclosed UN oil for popsicles program. Should we apologize and return the country to Saddam Hussein and his winsome sons? Should we have him on Designer's Challenge to put his palaces back in all their 80s Vegas splendor? Or maybe Uday and Kusei could spruce up each other's rape rooms on a very special episode of Trading Spaces. What is liberals' point? No one cares. The question was never whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We know he had weapons of mass destruction because he used weapons of mass destruction against the Kurds, against the Iranians, and against his own people. The United Nations weapons inspectors repeatedly found Saddam's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War, right up until Saddam threw them out in 1998. Justifying his impeachment day bombing, Clinton cited the Iraqi regime's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs. Indeed, to date, this constitutes the only evidence that Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Bill Clinton said he did. Liberals are now pretending that their position all along was that Saddam had secretly disarmed in the last few years without telling anyone. But that wasn't liberals' position, though it would finally explain the devilish question of why Saddam thwarted inspectors every inch of the way for 12 years, issued phony reports to the UN, and wouldn't allow flyovers or unannounced inspections. It was because he had nothing to hide. Liberals also have to pretend that the only justification for war given by the Bush administration was that Iraq was knee-deep in nukes, anthrax, biological weapons, and chemical weapons, so much so that even Hans Blix couldn't help but notice them. But that wasn't the Bush administration's position. Rather, it was that there were lots of reasons to get rid of Saddam Hussein and none to keep him. When President Bush gave the Hussein regime 48 hours' notice to quit Iraq, he said, "All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end." He told the Iraqi people there would be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors, no more poison factories, no more executions of dissidents, no more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near. Liberals kept saying that's too many reasons. The New York Times' leading hysteric, Frank Rich, complained, "We know Saddam Hussein is a thug, and we want him gone. But the administration has never stuck to a single story in arguing the case for urgent, preemptive action now. Since liberals never print retractions, they can say anything. What they said in the past is always deemed inadmissible and unfair to quote." Contrary to their current self-advertisements, it was liberals who were citing Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, and with gusto, in order to argue against war with Iraq. They said America would suffer retaliatory strikes, there would be mass casualties, Israel would be nuked, our troops would be hit with Saddam's chemical weapons. It would be a Vietnam quagmire. Their position was all we needed to do was disarm him, which would have required a military occupation of Iraq and a systematic inspection of 1,000 or so known Iraqi weapons sites without interference from the Hussein regime. In other words, pretty much what we're doing right now. That's why liberals were so smitten with the idea of relying on UN weapons inspectors. As their title indicates, weapons inspectors inspect weapons. They don't stop torture, abolish rape rooms, feed the people, topple Saddam's statues, or impose democracy. In January this year, the New York Times' Nicholas Kristof cited the sort of dismal CIA report that always turns up in the hands of New York Times reporters, warning that Saddam might order attacks with weapons of mass destruction as his last chance to exact vengeance by taking a large number of victims with him. Kristof said he opposed invading Iraq simply as a matter of the costs and benefits of an invasion, concluding we should not invade because there was clearly a significant risk that it would make America less safe. In his native tongue, weaselese, Kristof claimed he would be gung-ho for war if only he were convinced we could oust Saddam with minimal casualties and quickly establish a democratic Iraq. We've done that, and now he's angry that his predictions of calamity didn't come true. That's Bush's fault, too. Kristof says Bush manipulated evidence of weapons of mass destruction, an act of duplicity he calls just as alarming as a brutal dictator who has weapons of mass destruction. If Americans were lied to, they were lied to by liberals, who warned we would be annihilated if we attacked Iraq. The left's leading intellectual light, Janine Garofalo, was featured in an anti-war commercial before the war, saying, "If we invade Iraq, there's a United Nations estimate that says there will be up to 500,000 people killed or wounded." Now they're testy, because they realize Saddam may never have had even a sporting chance to kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. Taking Liberties, July 16, 2003. After Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt rounded up more than 100,000 Japanese residents and citizens and threw them into internment camps. Indeed, both liberal deities of the 20th century, FDR and Earl Warren, supported the internment of Japanese Americans. In the 20s, responding to the bombing of 8 government officials' homes, a Democrat-appointed attorney general arrested about 6,000 people. The raids were conducted by A. Mitchell Palmer, appointed by still-revered segregationist Democrat Woodrow Wilson, who won the 1916 election based on lies about intelligence and war plans. In response to the worst terrorist attack in the history of the world, right here on U.S. soil, Attorney General John Ashcroft has detained fewer than 1,000 Middle Eastern immigrants. Ashcroft faces a far more difficult task than FDR did. Pearl Harbor was launched by the imperial government of Japan, not by Japanese Americans living in California. The 9/11 Muslim terrorists, by contrast, were not only in the United States, but, until the attack, had not broken any laws, aside from a few immigration laws, which liberals don't care about anyway. And yet, without internment camps or mass arrests, Ashcroft's carefully tailored policies have prevented another terrorist attack for almost 2 years since the 9/11 attack. Naturally, therefore, the Democrats have focused like a laser beam on the perfidy of John Ashcroft. Representative Dick Gephardt recently said, "In my first 5 seconds as president, I would fire John Ashcroft as attorney general. In his first 4 seconds, he would establish the AFL-CIO wing of the White House." Senator John Kerry has vowed, "When I am president of the United States, there will be no John Ashcroft trampling on the Bill of Rights." Experts are still trying to figure out why Kerry didn't mention his service in Vietnam during that last statement. Senator John Edwards said that, We must not allow people like John Ashcroft to take away our rights and our freedoms. Apparently we must, however, allow Janet Reno to run over our rights and our freedoms with a tank. As usual, the Democrats have come up with a lot of bloody adjectives, but are a bit short in the way of particulars as to how Ashcroft is trampling on anyone's rights. Their case in chief seems to be Tarek Albasti. Albasti's story has now run in more than 70 overwrought news reports. His tale of torment led a New York Times report on terrorism suspects whose lives have been uprooted. He was the featured story on a PBS special about the civil liberties crisis sweeping America. Tarek Albasti is an Egyptian immigrant who married an American woman, brought 7 of his Egyptian friends to America, and was enrolled in flight school when America was hit on 9/11. Based on a tip from the ex-wife of one of the men that they were plotting a suicide mission, the 8 Egyptian immigrants were held for 1 week in October 2001. 1 week. The men were questioned and released. Since then, the government has issued copious apologies to the men and has expunged their records. What are liberals claiming law enforcement was supposed to do with information like that? We're sorry for any Arabs whose dearest dream was to go into crop dusting, but this really isn't a good time. Perhaps we could institute a 5-day waiting period for Muslims who apply to U.S. flight schools for a background check. Albasti told PBS, that's right, PBS, the television network owned, operated, and funded by the very same federal government Albasti now claims is oppressing him, that during his 1 week confinement he was worried he would be hanged without anyone ever knowing what happened to him. For that remark alone, he should be deported. Is that what he thinks of America? But at least detained Arabs, and more to the point their lawyers, have a monetary incentive to make absurd claims of persecution. What is the Democrats' excuse? Based on the wails from our stellar crop of Democratic presidential candidates, you would think every Muslim in the country is cowering in fear of John Ashcroft. But their case in chief, proving the existence of a civil rights crisis in America, is that 8 Egyptian immigrants, 1 in flight school no less, were detained for 1 week after the ex-wife of one of the men tipped off the FBI to a possible terrorist plot in the making. Apparently, a lot of the false tips to law enforcement are coming from ex-wives. Maybe Muslim men should have thought of that before introducing the burqa. Eshassa Fouad, a Moroccan student, was detained in Texas after his former wife accused him of being a terrorist. She is now serving a 1-year prison sentence for making a false charge. But someday, small children will be reading somber historical accounts about the dark night of fascism under John Ashcroft. Of course, thanks to Ashcroft, at least they'll be reading them in English rather than Arabic. If liberals applied half as much energy to some business endeavor as they do to creating the big lie, they would all be multimillionaires. What are we to make of people who promote the idea that America is in the grip of a civil liberties emergency based on 100 hazy stories of scowls and bumps and 1 week detentions? Manifestly, there is no civil liberties crisis in this country. People who claim there is must have a different goal in mind. How to Lose a War, September 10, 2003. Vermont Governor Howard Dean has been issuing diatribes against the Bush administration that would beat Tariq Aziz with severe menstrual cramps. This strategy has made him the runaway favorite of the Democratic Party. Even Mr. War Hero, John Kerry, is getting shellacked by Dean. At times, Kerry seems almost ready to surrender, making him look even more French. If only Kerry had a war record or an enormously rich spouse to fall back on. In the wake of Dean's success, the entire Democratic Dream Team is beginning to talk like Dr. Demento. On the basis of their recent pronouncements, the position of the Democratic Party seems to be that Saddam Hussein did not hit us on 9/11, Halliburton did. Explaining his vote for a war that he then immediately denounced, Kerry recently said his vote was just a head fake, leading some to wonder how many of Kerry's other votes in the U.S. Senate this would explain. He voted for a war only to bluff Saddam Hussein into letting in the UN weapons inspectors. It was right to have a threat of force, Kerry said, because it's only the threat of force that got Hans Blix and the inspectors back in the country. But he never imagined that Bush would interpret the open-ended war resolution as grounds to start an actual war. The difference is, Kerry said, I would have worked with the United Nations. None of the Democrats has the guts to come out and demand that the United States turn tail and run when the going gets tough. If only one of them had the courage to demand cowardice like a real Democrat. Instead, they stamp their feet and demand that Bush go to the United Nations. Apparently, it is urgent that we replace the best fighting force in the world with an international peacekeeping force, a task force both feared and respected worldwide for its ability to distribute powdered cheese to poor children. Inconsolable that their pleas to work through the UN did not stop Bush from invading Iraq and deposing Saddam Hussein, now the Democrats are eager for the UN to get involved. Since we didn't let the UN lose the war for us, the least we can do is let them screw up the peace. The idea that we would involve those swine in the post-war occupation of Iraq is so preposterous that it's under serious consideration as next week's slogan for the Howard Dean campaign. I hesitate to raise it to the level of a serious argument by offering a rebuttal, but as luck would have it, we have two models for how to occupy a country after a war. At the risk of giving away the ending, getting the Allies involved is not the successful model. After World War II, the United States ran the Japanese occupation unilaterally. Without the meddling of other nations, the Japanese occupation went off without a hitch. Within 5 years, General Douglas MacArthur had imposed a constitutional democracy on Japan with a bicameral legislature, a Bill of Rights, and an independent judiciary. Now the only trouble Japan causes us is its insistence on selling cars and small trucks to Americans at good prices. By contrast, the German occupation was run as liberals would like to run post-war Iraq, a joint affair among the Allies, the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. It took 45 years to clean up the mess they created. The Soviets bickered with the French, refusing to treat them as allies, on the admittedly sensible grounds that they didn't fight. While plundering their zone, the Soviets refused to relinquish any territory to France. Trying to be gallant, the Americans and the British carved a French zone out of their own sectors. The Soviets then blockaded Berlin and built the Berlin Wall, and Germany was split for the next half century. The British made Germany's war-torn economy worse by trying to impose socialism in their zone, as well as in their country. Predictably, economic disaster ensued. Over the next 5 years, the United States was required to spend the equivalent of about $200 billion annually in today's dollars to bail out Western Europe under the Marshall Plan. I note that there was no need for a Marshall Plan in Japan. And the disastrous German occupation is the best-case scenario for international peacekeeping. The less successful version includes our international peacekeeping in Somalia in 1993, leading to the corpses of American servicemen being defaced and one corpse being dragged through the streets by dancing, cheering savages. Showing that America is not a country to be toyed with, our draft-dodging, pot-smoking commander-in-chief responded by withdrawing our troops. So naturally, the Democrats are rooting for an international force in Iraq. The Democratic logic on national defense is, as soon as anyone in the military gets his hair mussed, we must pull out and bring in international peacekeeping forces. Our boys are in harm's way. People are dying. Bush lied when he said major combat operations were over. Let's run. That'll show 'em. It was not lost on Osama bin Laden that it only took 18 dead in Somalia for the great Satan to pull out. It should not be lost on Americans that this is what the Democrats are again demanding we do in Iraq. The Plan, November 5, 2003. The Democrats' new method of opposing the war on terrorism while pretending not to oppose the war on terrorism is to keep demanding that Bush produce a plan. Senator John Kerry said the difference in how he would have prosecuted the war in Iraq is, I would have planned. Yes, the invasion of Iraq was the usual unplanned, spur-of-the-minute thing that took 18 months of discussion. Wesley Clark recently complained that Bush had put American troops in harm's way without a plan. Of course, Clark's plan would have been to create a quagmire, just like he did in Bosnia. Senator John Edwards noted for the record that when he voted for war with Iraq, I said at the time that it was critical for us to have a plan. This president has no plan of any kind that I can see. Maybe it's that Beatlemania mop top that's blocking Edwards's view. Senator Joe Lieberman, the one Democratic presidential candidate too conservative for Barbara Streisand, said that President Bush gave the American people a price tag, not a plan. He said, "We in Congress must demand a plan. You know, like that incredibly detailed plan the Democrats have in place to spend $400 billion buying prescription drugs for elderly millionaires." Senator Edward Kennedy said, "The administration had a plan to fight the war, but it had no plan to win the peace. Kennedy's idea of a plan consists of choosing a designated driver before heading out for the evening." The Democrats' urgent need for an exit strategy apparently first arose sometime after 1993, when Bill Clinton sent all those U.S. soldiers to Bosnia, who are still there. Interviewing Vice President Dick Cheney on Meet the Press about a month ago, Tim Russert echoed the theme, asking, "What is our plan for Iraq? How long will the 140,000 American soldiers be there? How many international troops will join them? And how much is this going to cost? Are we there yet, Daddy? Can I go to the bathroom? Are we there yet? How much longer?" The same questions were asked of FDR over and over again by the American people after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. How much will this cost? My husband's a sailor. How long will he be gone? What's your exit strategy, you warmonger? Wait. No. My mistake. That didn't happen. The Democrats' incessant demand for a plan tends to suggest there is something called the plan, which would magically prevent bad things from ever happening, especially something as totally unexpected as violence in the Middle East. Violence in the Middle East constantly comes as a bolt out of the blue to liberals. We're at war with Islamic lunatics. They enjoy blowing things up and killing people. What further insights do liberals have to impart about this war? Bush said deposing Saddam Hussein and building a democracy in Iraq was an essential part of the war on terrorism. He did not say that invading Iraq would instantly end all Muslim violence and rainy days that make liberals blue. A war is not as predictable as, say, a George Clooney movie, although generally more entertaining. Historian Stephen Ambrose described General Dwight Eisenhower's genius as a soldier, noting that he often said that in preparing for battle, plans were essential, but that once the battle was joined, plans were useless. Transforming a blood-soaked police state dotted with mass graves into a self-governing republic might take slightly longer than this week's makeover on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. This is not the first time an evil tyrant was deposed, only to have bloody elements of his regime remain. For example, it's been nearly 5 months since Howell Raines was removed as editor of the New York Times. What is Bill Keller's plan to turn the New York Times around, and how long will it take? And when will liberals give us an exit strategy for their utterly failed 40-year war on poverty? The U.S. military has had considerably more success in turning Iraq around than liberals have had in turning the ghettos around with their war on poverty. Indeed, so far, fewer troops have been killed by hostile fire since the end of major combat in Iraq than civilians were murdered in Washington, D.C. last year, 239 deaths in Iraq compared with 262 murders in the U.S. Capitol. How many years has it been since we declared the end of major U.S. combat operations against Marion Barry's regime? How long before we just give up and pull out of that hellish quagmire known as Washington, D.C.? The Democrats' conception of a plan is like the liberal fantasy that there's a room somewhere full of unlimited amounts of free money that we could just give to teachers and hospitals and poor people and AIDS sufferers and the homeless if only the bad, greedy Republicans would give us the key to that wonderful room. Republicans should claim the plan is in that room, in a lockbox. It's interesting that after we've finally gotten liberals to give up on 7 decades of trying to plan an economy, now they want to plan a war. Extra credit question for the class. Comparing a peacetime economy with a war, which do you think is more likely to shoot back at the planners and require subsequent readjustments? No, no, not the usual hands from the eager YAFers in the front row. Are there any liberals in the back rows who want to take a stab at answering this one? Paul Krugman? Needless to say, the Democrats have no actual plan of their own, unless surrender counts as a plan. They just enjoy complaining about every bombing, every attack from Muslim terrorists, every mishap. Back in the 1870s, General William Tecumseh Sherman told a group of graduating cadets, "There are many of you here who think that war is all glory. Well, war is all hell. We didn't start it, but we're going to win it." December 14, 2003. Saddam Hussein is captured. It's like Christmas in December, December 17, 2003. Say, has anyone asked Dick Gephardt if this falls under miserable failure? Obviously, we'll have to wait for all the politics to play out, but at this stage, it's hard to say which was worse for Howard Dean this week, the capture of Saddam Hussein or Al Gore's endorsement. Until Sunday, Governor Meade's big applause line in speeches has been to sneer about the Bush administration's failure to catch Saddam Hussein. It seems the governor is better at prescribing bitter pills than at swallowing them. In a speech to the Pacific Council the day after Saddam was captured, Dean nearly choked on the words, "The capture of Saddam is a good thing," before quickly adding, "But the capture of Saddam has not made America safer." Possible headline, Dean says Saddam's capture good thing, just not really good thing. If George W. Bush announced that a cure for cancer had been discovered, Democrats would complain about unemployed laboratory rats. On Fox News Sunday, Senator John F. Kerry said of Saddam's capture, "This is a great opportunity for this president to get it right for the long term, and I hope he will be magnanimous, reach out to the UN, to allies who've stood away from us." It's as if he were reading my mind. After listening to all the bellyaching from European leftists for the past 8 months, I think I speak for all Americans when I say I've been waiting for just the right opportunity to grovel to the French. And now we have it. A major win is the perfect opportunity. That Kerry, he has an uncanny sense for what the average American is thinking. Actually, to tell the truth, he lost me with that one. Maybe it's a good opportunity for the French and the United Nations to reach out to us. But by what logic is this an opportunity for us to reach out to them? As I understand it, the situation is, we caught Saddam. So the obvious next move is, A, put him on trial. B, get information from him. C, torture him. D, turn him over to the Iraqis. E, appeal to the French. What was interesting about Kerry's suggestion was that it was the exact same suggestion liberals were making when they claimed the war was going badly. The day before Saddam's capture, the New York Times editorialized, "The way to deal with all that is going wrong in Iraq remains as clear as it was on the day that Mr. Bush declared an end to major combat operations. Instead of driving away France, Germany, Russia, and Canada with financial sanctions, the president should be creating the room for compromise." Damn that Bush. He squandered the goodwill of a bunch of people who hate our guts. I guess this is what liberals mean by a plan. Military setback. Appeal to the French. Military victory. Appeal to the French. Saddam captured. Appeal to the French. Osama captured. Appeal to the French. Osama catches Saddam. Appeal to the French. In 24 months, Bush has perceptibly degraded terrorist operations throughout the world. The rebuilding in Iraq is going better than could possibly have been expected. Liberals don't care. They just want to turn everything over to the French. And apparently, the recent capture of Saddam presents us with a golden opportunity to do so. The Birchers were right about these people. They believe in world government more than they believe in the United States. One strongly suspects that the White House sat on the story of Saddam's capture for a day so the Times could put out its regular Sunday bad news. A Baghdad neighborhood, once hopeful, now reels as Iraq's turmoil persists. Saboteurs, looters, and old equipment work against efforts to restart Iraqi oil fields. It's going to be a bloody Christmas. The New York Times hasn't looked this foolish, well, I guess since the day before. Liberals should perk up. It's not all bad news. True, Saddam Hussein has been captured, but Norman Mineta is still at large. Al-Qaeda barks, the Spanish fly. March 17, 2004. After a terrorist attack by Al-Qaeda that left hundreds of their fellow countrymen dead, Spanish voters immediately voted to give the terrorists what they want, a socialist government that opposes America's war on terrorism. Al-Qaeda has changed a government. Until the bombings last week, the center-right Popular Party of outgoing Prime Minister José María Aznar had been sailing to victory. But then the Al-Qaeda bombs went off, and Spaniards turned out in droves to vote against the government that had been a staunch Bush ally in the war on terrorism. I guess it's okay for a Spanish socialist to politicize a terrorist attack just to get elected. In a videotaped message, the Al-Qaeda military commander for Europe claimed credit for the bombings, saying that the terrorist attack was meant to punish Spain for supporting the war in Iraq. The message came as a total shock to liberals, who have been furiously insisting that Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Apparently, Al-Qaeda didn't think so. After the Madrid bombings, it looks like liberals and terrorists will have to powwow on whether there was an Iraq-Al-Qaeda link. 200 dead Spaniards say there was. The New York Times calls the Spanish election an exercise in healthy democracy. And an ATM withdrawal with a gun to your head is a routine banking transaction. Instead of vowing to fight the people who killed their fellow citizens, the Spanish decided to vote with Al-Qaeda on the war. A murdering terrorist organization said jump, and an entire country answered how high. One Spaniard who decided to switch his vote in reaction to the bombings told the Times, "Maybe the socialists will get our troops out of Iraq, and Al-Qaeda will forget about Spain, so we will be less frightened. That's the fighting spirit. If the violent Basque separatist group only killed more people, Spain would surely give them what they want, too." After his stunning upset victory, Socialist Party leader José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero said he would withdraw Spanish troops from Iraq if the United States does not turn over Iraq to the United Nations. He also vowed that all of Spain's remaining trains will run on time. Zapatero said the war with Iraq had only caused violence, and there were no reasons for it. One reason for the war, which would be a sufficient reason for a more manly country, is that the people who just slaughtered 200 Spaniards didn't like it. But, like the Democrats, the Spanish hate George Bush more than they hate the terrorists. Zapatero said the war in Iraq was based on lies and called on President Bush and Tony Blair to do some reflection and self-criticism. So don't think of the Spanish election as a setback for freedom. Think of it as a preview of life under President John Kerry. What kind of lunatic would blame Bush for 200 Spaniards killed by Al-Qaeda bombs? Oh, wait, Howard Dean just did. Summarizing the views of socialists everywhere, Dean said, "The president was the one who dragged our troops to Iraq, which apparently has been a factor in the death of 200 Spaniards over the weekend." Yes, with 1,700 dead or injured Spaniards, George Bush certainly has some explaining to do. What have the terrorists ever done besides kill and maim thousands of innocent civilians? Bush isn't fully funding No Child Left Behind, for God's sake. Before he was put into office because he supported policies favored by Al-Qaeda terrorists, appeasement candidate Zapatero said, "I want Kerry to win." Kerry is also supported by North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il, who broadcasts Kerry's speeches over Radio Pyongyang with favorable commentary. So now Kerry really does have two foreign leaders on record supporting him, a socialist terrorist appeaser and a Marxist mass murderer who dresses like B. Arthur. Zapatero predicted that his own victory would help the anti-war party in the duel between Bush and Kerry. Would you mind repeating that, sir? I was distracted by that large white flag you're waving. However Spain's election affects Americans, we can be sure that Spain's surrender to terrorism hasn't been lost on the terrorists. It's difficult to imagine the American people responding to a new terrorist attack by deciding to placate the terrorists, as the Spanish did. A mollusk wouldn't react that way to an attack. Only a liberal could be so perverse. No matter how many of our European allies may surrender to the terrorists, America will never be alone. This is a country founded in a covenant with God by people who had to flee Europe to do it. Sailing to the New World in 1630 on the ship Arabella, the Puritans' leader and governor, John Winthrop, said that Americans were entering a covenant with God to create a city upon a hill. He said we would be judged by all the world if we ever broke that covenant. But if we walked with God, we shall find that the God of Israel is among us, when 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies. He has intervened in our affairs before, such as in 1776, 1861, and 1980. With the Spanish election, we are witnessing a capitulation to savagery that makes full-scale war inevitable. The Democratic candidate wants to represent godless Europeans. The Republican candidate wants to represent Americans. As Winthrop said, "The eyes of all people are upon us." Tit for Tet, May 25, 2004. Abu Ghraib is the new Tet Offensive. By lying about the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War, the media managed to persuade Americans we were losing the war, which demoralized the nation and caused us to lose the war. And people say reporters are lazy. The immediate consequence of the media's lies about the Tet Offensive was a 25% drop in support for the war. The long-term consequence for America was 12 years in the desert until Ronald Reagan came in and saved the country. Now liberals are using their control of the media to persuade the public that we are losing the war in Iraq. Communist dictators may have been ruthless murderers bent on world domination, but they displayed a certain degree of rationality. America may not be able to wait out 12 years of Democrat pusillanimity now that we're dealing with Islamic lunatics who slaughter civilians in suicide missions while chanting Allah Akbar. And yet the constant drumbeat of failure, quagmire, Abu Ghraib, Bush lied, kids died, has been so successful that merely to say the war in Iraq is going well provokes laughter. The distortions have become so pervasive that Michael Moore teeters on the brink of being considered a reliable source. If President Bush mentions our many successes in Iraq, it is evidence that he is being unrealistically sunny and optimistic, as Michael O'Hanlon of the Liberal Brookings Institution put it. O'Hanlon's searing indictment of the operation in Iraq is that we need to make sure that they have some budget resources that they themselves decide how to spend that are not already pre-allocated. So that's the crux of our challenge in Iraq. Make sure their accounts receivable columns all add up. Whenever great matters are at stake, you can always count on liberals to have some pointless, womanly complaint. We have liberated the Iraqi people from a brutal dictator who gassed his own people, had weapons of mass destruction, invaded his neighbors, harbored terrorists, funded terrorists, and had reached out to Osama bin Laden. Liberals may see Saddam's mass graves in Iraq as half full, but I prefer to see them as half empty. So far, we have found chemical and biological weapons, brucella and Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever, ricin, sarin, aflatoxin, and long-range missiles in Iraq. The terrorist stronghold of Karbala was abandoned last week by Islamic crazies loyal to cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who slunk away when it became clear that no one supported them. Iraqis living in Karbala had recently distributed flyers asking the rebels to please leave, further underscoring one of the principal remaining problems in Iraq, the desperate need for more Kinko's outlets. Last weekend, our troops patrolled this rebel stronghold without a shot being fired. The entire Kurdish region, one-third of the country, is patrolled by about 300 American troops, which is fewer than it takes to patrol the Kennedy compound in Palm Beach on Easter weekends. But the media tell us this means we are losing. The goalpost of success keeps shifting as we stack up a string of victories. Before the war, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof warned that war with Iraq would be a nightmare. We won't kill Saddam, trigger a coup, or wipe out his Republican Guard forces. Unless, he weaseled his way out, we're incredibly lucky. We've done all that. How incredibly lucky. Kristof continued, we'll have to hunt out Saddam on the ground, which may be just as hard as finding Osama in Afghanistan, and much bloodier. We've captured Saddam, and it wasn't bloody. Indeed, the most harrowing aspect of Saddam's capture was that he hadn't bathed or been de-liced for 2 months. Kristof also said, our last experience with street-to-street fighting was confronting untrained thugs in Mogadishu, Somalia. This time, we're taking on an army with possible bio and chemical weapons, 400,000 regular army troops, and supposedly 7 million more in Al-Quds militia. And yet, somehow, our boys defeated them in just a few weeks. Incredibly lucky again. And just think, all of this accomplished without even having a plan. Now we're fighting directly with Islamic loonies crawling out of their rat holes from around the entire region, which liberals also said wouldn't happen. Remember how liberals said the Islamic loonies hated Saddam Hussein? Hated him because he was a secularist? As geopolitical strategist Paul Begala put it, Saddam would never share his weapons with terrorists because those Islamic terrorists would use them against Saddam Hussein because he's secular. Well, apparently the crazies have put aside their scruples about Saddam's secularism to come out in the open where they can be shot by American troops rather than fighting on the streets of Manhattan, where the natives would immediately surrender. The beauty of being a liberal is that history always begins this morning. Every day, liberals can create a new narrative that destroys the past as it occurred. We have always been at war with East Asia. To be sure, Iraq is not a bed of roses. As the Brookings Institution scholar said, we have yet to give the Iraqis budget resources that are not already pre-allocated. I take it back. It is a quagmire. This is History Calling. Quick, get me rewrite. June 3, 2004. The invasion of Iraq has gone fabulously well, exceeding everyone's expectations, certainly exceeding the doomsday scenarios of liberals. The Bush haters' pre-war predictions, hundreds of thousands dead, chemical attacks on our troops, retaliatory terrorist attacks in the United States, an invasion by Turkey, oil facilities in flames, and apocalyptic environmental consequences have proven to be about as accurate as Bill Clinton's legally accurate statements about Monica Lewinsky. Inasmuch as they can't cite any actual failures in Iraq, liberals busy themselves by claiming the administration somehow misled them about the war. As I understand it, there would be no lunatics shouting, Bush lied, kids died, if Paul Wolfowitz had admitted before the war that Saddam probably hadn't rebuilt his nuclear program, the one that was unilaterally blown up by the Israelis in 1981, thank God. What Wolfowitz should have said is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the way you think about law enforcement, and I think we are much closer to being in a state of war than being in a judicial proceeding. Liberals would be all sugar and sweetness if only, instead of blathering about nukes, 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 Wolfowitz had forthrightly conceded back in 2002 that there's an awful lot we don't know, an awful lot that we may never know, and we've got to think differently about standards of proof here. Also, I assume we wouldn't be hearing that the administration is frustrated by its failure to instantly create a Jeffersonian democracy in Iraq if Wolfowitz had said something like, well, Japan isn't Jeffersonian democracy either. If only Wolfowitz had lowered expectations by saying that even if Iraq makes it only Romanian style, that's still such an advance over anywhere else in the Arab world. Also, the media would have no grounds for complaint if Wolfowitz had said Iraqi democracy is not the president's declared purpose of regime change in Iraq, which is to get rid of a very bad man. If only he had mentioned that Saddam Hussein has been known to have children tortured in front of their parents. But guess what? That is exactly what Wolfowitz did say. All these quotes are from a September 22, 2002 article in the New York Times Magazine written by Bill Keller, now editor-in-chief at the seditious Rag. The last paragraph, about Saddam's torture of children, is Keller paraphrasing Wolfowitz. The rest are direct quotes from the wily neoconservative himself. But you'd have to put liberals in Abu Ghraib to get them to tell the truth about what people were saying before the war. And then the problem would be that most liberals would enjoy those activities. No torture has yet been devised that could get a liberal to mention the poor, beleaguered Kurds dancing in the streets because Saddam is gone. To refresh everyone's recollection, before the war began, the Democrats' argument was that Iraq was not an imminent threat to the United States. The Republicans' argument was, by the time the threat is imminent, Chicago will be gone. Bush's January 2003 State of the Union address specifically responded to the Democrats' demand that we wait for nuclear and biological threats to be imminent before we act, saying that if we waited for this threat to fully and suddenly emerge, all actions and words and all recriminations would come too late. But now liberals want to have their Nigerian yellow cake and eat it too. In January 2003, or 3 months after Senator Tom Daschle voted for the Iraq War resolution, hoping to fool the voters of South Dakota this November, he was horrified that Bush seemed to be actually contemplating war with Iraq. According to Daschle, Bush should have waited for Iraq to grow into a problem of crisis proportions before deciding to do anything, citing the Cuban Missile Crisis as a model to be emulated. If we have proof of nuclear and biological weapons, Daschle asked, why doesn't Bush show that proof to the world as President Kennedy did 40 years ago when he sent Adlai Stevenson to show the world U.S. photographs of offensive missiles in Cuba? The answer is, because by the time Saddam had nuclear weapons, we wouldn't be able to do anything. That's why it's known as the Cuban Missile Crisis, not the Cuban Missile Triumph. Before the war, Democrats were carping about the Bush administration's inability to predict the future and tell us everything that would happen in Iraq after the war. On MSNBC in September 2002, for example, Robert Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, was complaining that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld didn't have an answer for what happens in a post-Saddam Iraq. But now liberals are acting as if the Bush administration said they knew exactly what would happen after liberating a country from a 30-year barbaric dictatorship and got it wrong. The good news is, liberals' anti-war hysteria seems to have run its course. I based this conclusion on Al Gore's lunatic anti-war speech last week. Gore always comes out swinging just as an issue is about to go south. He's the stereotypical white guy always clapping on the wrong beat. Gore switched from being a pro-defense Democrat to a lefty peacenik just before the 9/11 attack. He grew a beard, just in time for an attack on the nation by fundamentalist Muslims. He endorsed Howard Dean, just as the orange-capped Deaniacs were imploding. Gore even went out and got really fat, just before America officially gave up carbs. This guy is always leaping into the mosh pit at the precise moment the crowd parts. Mark my words, now that good old Al has come lunging in, the anti-war movement is dead. Chapter 3. A Muslim by Any Other Name Blows Up Just the Same. John Davis, American Hero, July 29, 1999. My life is almost complete. Tonight, I was on a TV show on extreme catfighting, the closest I'll ever get to Jerry Springer, and I shook hands with John Davis. hero to frequent flyers everywhere. Now, if I can just manage to rear-end Kate Michaelman of Neral, I can call it a day. Mild-mannered Davis was attempting to fly Continental Airlines to Florida with his wife and toddler child a couple of weeks ago. For frequent flyers, your stomach is already in a knot. After the standard 2-hour delay, Davis's child broke from his parents and ran onto the jetway leading to the aircraft, presumably hoping to start a trend. The accounts of the resulting altercation begin to differ at this point, so to be fair, I'll go with the version that reflects most poorly on my hero. As John Davis and his wife were running for their pre-boarding toddler on the jetway, the Continental Airlines ticket taker blocked Mr. Davis's way, stood between father and child, and informed Mr. Davis that he could not enter the jetway without a boarding pass. Remember, all this Continental Airlines readily admits. The father responded the way fathers are wont to do in such situations, which is violently. Davis is a slight man. The damage he did to the ticket taker reminds one of biology class lessons on adrenaline that involve mothers lifting Volkswagens to release pinned children. The lesson of this and many other happy travel stories is that humans are fascists by nature. Give some humans control over other humans, and they will seamlessly transform into brown shirts, patting you down, ripping apart your belongings, breaking your valuables, and telling you where to stand, to drink, and to smoke, and when to go to the bathroom. And if you complain, they will arrest you. Worse, they will bump you or your luggage or take away your nice aisle seat and give you a center seat. But the head of Continental Airlines reacted as if his faithful employee had brilliantly averted another toddler down the jetway scam. He called for a federal law, not banning hairless simians from total control over other people's lives at airports, but banning violent passengers from the airways. Interestingly, he said air rage cannot be tolerated, no matter what the reason. No matter what the reason. Even in case of rape or incest or if the mother's life is in danger, a no-matter-what-the-reason standard could come only from a person who flashes a Chief Executive Continental Airlines card when he flies. Admittedly, I have seen plenty of dumb and nasty passengers. Some Hollywood celebrities don't even have the common courtesy to wait their turn to defecate on a beverage cart. And also plenty of patient, saintly airline employees who have completely suppressed the human instinct to fascism. And that's not just the Stockholm Syndrome talking. But if we're passing federal laws, a really useful federal law would be one that prohibits pilots from talking. There is nothing that makes you feel like you are in Orwell's 1984 so much as being trapped on an airplane with a pilot who thinks he's Shecky Green. You can't leave the plane, obviously. You generally can't even leave your seat or turn on your Walkman. The only other places in this country where you can be forced to listen to someone talk are prison and grade school. And prison guards and teachers have more interesting information than, if you look out your right window, you can see Cleveland. Several years ago, one of my father's business colleagues was trapped on a plane when the pilot began to play out his fantasy of being a tour guide. The colleague called a flight attendant over, handed her a section of his paper, and asked her to give it to the pilot so he'd stop with his incessant jabbering. When the plane landed, the businessman was arrested. That's a true story. Americans may vote for creeping socialism, but deep in their beings they sense that they are still free, that this is not yet Orwell's 1984. As long as there are some people who are not willing to roll over for the airline fascists and be docile sheep, stand in line, open your bag, walk through the metal detector again, take off your belt, take off your coat, take off your jewelry, stand in line, turn on your computer, present your ID. Has anyone given you anything? No drinking, no smoking. You'll have to check that. Stand here, sit down, don't get up, put your seat back up, turn off your computer. We're at 30,000 feet, and if you look to your left, you can see Pittsburgh. Whoops! And another plane down. Not because of the Waterford crystal the X-ray goon just broke in your carry-on luggage, but because of pilot error. there will be John Davises. Most of the fascistically controlling airline regulations are the result of, surprise, government regulations. I would risk terrorist sabotage not to have to be mauled by the X-ray crew, who see their sole life's work as trying to cause passengers to miss planes. That would be a completely rational trade-off, by the way, but the government won't allow consumers to make it. On average, there is one fatality for every 3 million people who fly on a commercial aircraft. You are more likely to drown in your bathtub than die in an airplane. 10 times more likely. In any 6-month period, more people will die in car accidents than have ever died in airplanes, in the history of flight. But the government doesn't require anyone to shake you down before you take a bath. You don't get the third degree every time you get behind the wheel of a car. So why are the consumers of airline travel patted down and interrogated like denizens of a crack house? Most of those rare air flight fatalities are the result of accidents, not terrorists anyway. Accidents are caused by pilots, government bureaucrats, and airline personnel, not passengers. But every time there's an airline crash due to pilot error, the government immediately springs into action by piling on yet more intrusive passenger interrogations. Moreover, if the airlines weren't required by the government to engage in moronic exercises, like asking every passenger if he packed his own bags, what are the odds that a terrorist would answer, "Why, no, the bomb squad back at terrorist headquarters did"? They would undoubtedly come up with actually plausible methods to keep their planes accident and terrorist-free. In-flight bombings are terrible PR. Airlines could, for example, put undercover armed guards on all their flights. They could allow passengers to fly armed. This would not only make air travel safer, it would prove once and for all the most compelling argument for gun rights by posing the rhetorical question, would you ever try to hijack a plane if you knew that every passenger aboard might be armed? Imagine how much more pleasant airline travel would be if the airport security moron were required to ask every passenger, "And did you load your concealed weapon yourself today, sir?" The government already carves out a little exception for itself on the no-guns rule. FBI agents are allowed to pack heat on commercial airlines, and, let me hasten to add, it wasn't armed civilians who mistakenly shot down Randy Weaver's wife, child, and dog. Alternatively, airlines could allow frequent flyers to submit to personal investigations in return for a special airline passport, allowing them to skip the make-them-miss-their-flights X-ray crew. These would be just like the ones flight attendants and pilots already have. But creative, consumer-friendly solutions are not possible because the government has given itself monopoly control of air safety. Let's just hope they don't find out about bathtub drownings. Where's Janet Reno when we need her? September 20th, 2001. Just as I predicted, the new security procedures adopted by the U.S. Department of Transportation in response to the most deadly hijackings in history will be incredibly burdensome for millions of American travelers, but at the same time, will do absolutely nothing to deter hijackers. The single most effective thing we could do in this country to protect travelers from terrorist attacks would be to abolish the Department of Transportation. The government's logical calculus on flight security has long been really annoying equals safe plane. Does anyone not know how to use a seatbelt? Say you were an alien from a distant galaxy and had never in your entire life seen a seatbelt before. Couldn't you figure it out? The FAA's new hijacker repellent is this. Passengers will now have to show boarding passes to get to the gates. This wily stratagem will stop cold any hijackers on suicide missions who forgot to buy airline tickets. It's times like this that I get down on my knees and thank God we have a federal Department of Transportation. The genius security procedures laboriously implemented by the government over the past decade certainly served this country well on Bloody Tuesday. The real puzzler is how the hijackers managed to evade the "Did you pack your own bags?" trap. Only further investigation will solve that mystery. If only we'd implemented the tough new cross-your-heart-and-hope-to-die follow-up question in time. Last week, a CNN anchor raised the did-you-pack-your-own-bags dragnet and somberly remarked, this is a quote, "No one will answer those questions so cavalierly again." We certainly won't. We will all remember that if those asinine questions hadn't been asked of millions of travelers day in, day out, year after year, enragingly stupid every time, 19 murderous hijackers might have boarded 4 separate commercial jets in America almost simultaneously one morning. Oh, no, wait. The hijackers weren't foiled. But somehow the manifest irrelevance of the "did you pack your own bags" question has become its principal selling point. We are also grateful for the magnetometers. The McDonald's rejects who man the machines are so efficient and courteous you hardly notice them anymore. That's sarcasm. Despite addled TV commentators claiming that, heretofore, travelers had breezed right through the metal detectors, these are obviously people who haven't flown since the 50s. Back on Earth, the sullen, dictatorial security personnel invariably stop all passengers who are not likely to punch them, girls, rifle through their belongings, slowly wipe some wand over their computers, a procedure that takes just long enough for you to almost miss your plane, carefully examine their persons down to the tiny metallic bra strap hook, and then methodically break any crystal vases the passenger is carrying. So don't tell me they're lazy. It may be annoying, but the rash of hijackings by Connecticut WASP girls surely explains the time-consuming, but still somehow completely useless, examination of my personal effects. We all have to make sacrifices for airline safety. Even with the shakedowns, I personally have carried a deadly plastic shiv and FBI mace through metal detectors dozens of times. Dozens. I wasn't even trying. I just forgot I was carrying them. Unless the government is going to require passengers, crew, and pilots to travel naked and with no luggage, there is no spot search devisable that can keep the sky safe, no matter how irritating. Consequently, I propose an all-new standard for airline safety procedures. Bear with me here, but my idea is this. We should be looking for procedures that make the airplane safer. With this new standard as my guide, I have a 5-point plan. 1. Pilots should be the first to board the plane, and the cockpit door should be locked like Fort Knox behind them, impenetrable by anyone until the plane lands. The cabin crew should be able to communicate with the pilots only to request an emergency landing, but nothing that needs to be spoken over an intercom, such as "fly to Kabul" or "every passenger gets his throat slit." 2. Every flight should carry at least 2 undercover agents capable of discharging hollow point bullets, poison darts, and electric shocks. The armed guards have to be incognito so that hijackers can't knock them off, and also to improve in-flight courtesy. 3. We should require passports to fly domestically. Passports can be forged, but they can also be checked with the home country in case of any suspicious-looking swarthy males. It will be a minor hassle, but it's better than national ID cards. It's also far less annoying than being told how to use a seatbelt. 4. All 19 hijackers in last week's attack appear to have been non-citizens. As far as the Constitution is concerned, visitors to this country are here at the nation's pleasure. Congress could pass a law tomorrow requiring that all aliens from Arabic countries leave. Congress could certainly pass a law requiring that all aliens get approval from the INS before boarding an airplane in the United States. 5. Of course, any security procedure imaginable can be breached by well-financed fanatics willing to commit suicide for their cause. The main deterrent to terrorists is to create despair and hopelessness by destroying their home sponsors. Donald Rumsfeld is just the man for the job. But on the off chance that he is insufficiently ruthless, Someone should tell Janet Reno that Islamic fundamentalism is an offshoot of the Branch Davidians. Hillary Care for the Airports, November 8, 2001. The main sticking point between the Senate and House versions of the aviation security bill now headed for conference is whether airport magnetometers will be run with private sector values or the smooth efficiency of the Department of Motor Vehicles. In the event that Congress chooses the latter, anyone planning to travel by air during this calendar year is hereby advised to leave for the airport now. This is lesson number 1,475,607,033 on the point that the free market is a counterintuitive concept. Only liberals still associate the words government employee with efficiency and competence. Without constant reminders of the material bounty produced by the glorious Soviet Union, people, by which I mean liberals, will list towards socialist solutions time and again. Even the lily-livered Europeans, usually cited warmly by the left for their progressive views on adultery, have abandoned the idea of government bureaucrats running security at airports. If there's one thing the Europeans know, it's how efficient a government employee who can't be fired can be. But the New York Times has been editorializing daily against private security firms in deference to, and I quote,